This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Haview,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
And today we are joined by Dr. Nora Ashora. Nora is a scientist based out of Boston specializing in T-cell-based cancer immunotherapy. After dabbling in dozens of different types of scientific research, she is now qualified to talk ad nauseum about how CD4 plus T cells are the EVs of the immune system, the metabolite kynurenine in the advancement of cancer, the surprising accuracy of the animal cells at work, and relating cancer immunotherapy to Star Wars. She has joined the cult of immunology, and there's no going back now. Nora, in light of that, welcome to the show.
How's it going? Thank you, guys. I think the first attempt on the metabolite kynurenine was as good of a first attempt as I've ever heard. Even my committee members at the end of my PhD could not properly say kynurenine in some cases.
Kynurenine, okay. And that is the correct.
It's like kind of like saying anemone. It's really hard to say. called it kyne. I just called it kyne after a while. I thought, that's enough.
Well, I can't wait to learn about what all those big words are.
Like I said, I can talk ad nauseum about kynurenine, and it's really upsetting.
Well, this is fantastic, Nora. I think this is a topic that people really want to hear about. I know I really want to hear about it. So why don't we dive right in? We are old friends, but why don't you just tell us, Nora, in your own words, what do you do?
So I think a really quick way of summarizing it is I work in different types of biotechnology that will enable your own immune system to combat its cancer. That has ended up being what I do. I didn't do it with the intention of being in the cancer immunotherapy space. I wanted to just study the immune system and how we can enable it to be better. And my research has just led me back to cancer every single time. And now I work in cancer immunotherapy in biotech, like in Boston. So that's kind of the easiest way of summarizing it. I want to take your immune system and make it better at combating its own cancer or its own disease, in the case maybe.
And that's generally what we call immunotherapy, right?
Yeah. Anything where like the primary mechanism of its efficacy, of its activity, is enabling your immune system to do the work that it's been evolved to do for a very long time. It's just having some hiccups because of the nature of the different disease that's affecting it. So especially in cancer, there's lots of mutations that occur in cancer that prevent your immune system from being able to respond to the tumor cells. And so what immunotherapy does is kind of bridge that gap and reactivate your immune system and remind it that, no, yes, this is a threat that you must deal with. Go do it. Don't be suppressed.
So I have lots of questions because I have absolutely no idea of anything you're talking about. but, you know, is this the sort of stuff, is it treated with drugs? How are these treatments given? Is this even stuff that's on the market, or is this all theoretical?
Tons of stuff on the market right now that are immunotherapeutics. And I say tons, but it's still not the standard of treatment. It's very difficult to treat, especially solid tumors, with immunotherapies. Not impossible, just difficult. There's not so many options. It's not like picking a pain medicine like Tylenol versus, you know, ibuprofen. It's not the same. It's not as common, but it is definitely available. A really good example of this actually coming out of Texas is Dr. Jim Allison, who works out of Houston, and his team is actually the people that created the anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1 immunotherapies that are used to treat both solid, like a lot of solid tumors, actually, in the first trials of that drug back in the early 2000s. I don't want to say the year because I might get the year wrong. They had a stage 4 patient, and she was 30 years old with melanoma. It was metastatic melanoma, and then she was cured.
Wow.
And she's been cancer-free for over 15 years. She has 2 kids now. Like
without surgery?
Without surgery.
Okay.
So quick question. So you said it's generally not it's not as good at solid tumors, right?
Or it's not used as, like, there aren't as many options for solid tumors. Like, a lot of people are trying to break into that space. It's just really hard because solid tumors, I mean, kind of exactly what it sounds like, tend to have a very big barrier around them. And so penetrating a solid tumor, getting into a solid tumor with cells, with immune cells, infiltration is really, really difficult.
Got
And I think it might actually be helpful to take a step back, because I could feel myself get into some alphabet soup, which is a tendency of a lot of.
I was just wondering what I thought all tumors were solid. What are the alternatives to solid? Are there soft tumors?
So leukemias and lymphomas, like those are blood cancers, right? That's just so different. And there are definitely, you know, anti-PD-1 therapies for different types of blood cancers. And I think I almost said one of our own targets. But, so there's lots of options. People are shooting for leukemia, lymphomas. They're just easier to treat because you inject, you know, whatever your immunotherapy is. There's lots of different modes of them. They're not just one thing or the other. And if it's already in circulation, that makes it a lot easier to kind of tackle this problem and get immune cell infiltration. Whereas if you have a solid tumor, like a sarcoma, for example, would be like a bone or muscle tumor, like that is very difficult to penetrate because there's a whole network of tumor cells that are literally compacted in, you know, they have tons of angiogenesis factors and like blood vessels recruited just to support tumor growth. And so now imagine you've activated your immune system successfully with your immunotherapy. They know that there's a problem. They know where the tumor is. They're getting in there on the front line. If an immune cell reaches a solid tumor and literally can't get into it to address it, then it's kind of a failed attempt, right?
Interesting.
And so lots of different modes of action can help with that, you know, helping to target directly to the tumor, find a factor that's expressed on tumors that will help you literally get in there, to help T cells, B cells, like other antigen presenting cells, B cells get in there and try and activate against it. Others, like the one I worked on in grad school, is actually an enzymatic depletion strategy. And so there are factors that are tend to get overexpressed or overproduced by cancer. And in our lab, one of the things that I worked on was an enzyme called kynurenase, very creatively named because it degrades kynurenin, that metabolite that we talked about at the beginning. And that factor tends to turn off immune cells that will naturally be recruited to a tumor margin. And so we get rid of that factor so that tumor cells or T cells, for example, can reactivate against the tumor. And then from there, they take care of it the way that they normally would, right?
I think that's a great segue for us to take a step back and take a look at maybe start with just the really big picture for like, how does immunotherapy fit into like the normal, maybe say already existing ecosystem of like treating disease in general, and then go into kind of how it activates. Cause I was trying to think about this yesterday. It's like, okay, like how do we treat diseases at all? Right. You think about like antibiotics, right. And so like an antibiotic will just directly in some ways, like actually just kill bacteria, right? It's not training necessarily your immune system to kill the bacteria. It's just that chemical is doing it, right? Whereas then in contrast, you could have, say, like chemotherapy, which is acting in a different way. And now immunotherapy, which is acting in a different way still. So can you just walk us through like fundamentally, like how is this differentiated from all the various ways that we treat disease?
Yeah. So I don't know about every single disease. Like I think the easier way to talk about it is probably just cancer, because cancer itself is really heterogeneous in terms of different strategies to address it.
Yeah, let's do that. And everyone wants cancer to go away. So
there's not a single person that wants that to stick around. So I think there's kind of three main ways to address cancer at the moment that are pretty standard, people are familiar with. The first is surgery. You cut a tumor out. This is for solid tumors, obviously, typically not for blood cancers. Some people do get transplant, like bone marrow transplants and stuff, to make sure that they don't continue making misbehaving tumor cells. And so surgery would definitely be one of them. Chemotherapy, which just basically chemically changes the nature of your body. I don't want to say it's poison, but it is essentially poison, where it's making the environment, the tumor microenvironment, very uncomfortable for tumor cells. And the hope is that it will kill tumor cells with that level of chemical change before it kills your normal cells. Your normal cells will tolerate it just a little bit longer than the tumor cells. And that's how it's getting rid of it. Plenty of radiation, which literally bombards solid tumors with radiation therapy, killing them. And again, that area becomes kind of permanently damaged. And there's lots of side effects to each of them. Surgery, for example, while critical, I would say still, is not sometimes sufficient to completely remove a tumor. There's kind of a saying that if you miss one or two cells, they can metastasize and go somewhere else. I've definitely seen that in my own personal experience. My dad was one of those patients where we had a full amputation and they missed a couple of cells and it metastasized. And that was kind of it. But it's still incredibly important. I think when people talk about different cancer therapies, most people are not talking about a one route approach. They're talking about a combination approach. And so maybe you'll have surgery and then you'll immediately get started on chemotherapy. Maybe you'll have radiation and then you'll have surgery. Like, it's kind of a mix of options. And one more mix, that thing to be added to that mix, is immunotherapy, which instead of kind of changing the fundamental chemical nature of the tumor microenvironment or bombarding with radiation, instead you're going to give something that's going to stimulate your immune system in some way, shape, or form. Again, many modes of action for that, to combat its own cancer. And so from there, you're allowed to maybe get surgery and then some immunotherapy or some right? Or maybe you've had chemotherapy and you weren't a responsive patient. Now you can try immunotherapy. Maybe you will be. And so it just depends on what route is best for the patient. In the future, the hope is that with more and more personalized medicine, with more and more access to genetic information about people's unique tumor, like their tumor genetic makeup, you'll be able to target very specifically what type of therapy somebody needs, because a lot of immunotherapy is biomarker related. Many immunotherapies are biomarker related.
Is it the kind of thing where it would have to be really specialized, like a different immunotherapy type therapeutic for like every different type of cancer, and it would have to be like identified in that way? It's not just going to be like a blanket solution to heal all things.
I don't know if it'd be, I think that's a good point. I don't think it would be for every single type of cancer, just because that's definitely not the way people are trying to solve it now, right? Like, we're trying to find the most common denominator between as many tumors as possible. I don't think it would be, oh, there's my cat. There won't be a one size fits all for every single tumor type. But a good example, actually coming from my dissertation research, is that one mutation that crops up a lot in a lot of different types of tumors is mutations in an enzyme called IDO. That's the abbreviation. It's in dolomine 2,3 dioxygenase. We don't have to get too into it just yet. But that mutation crops up in lots of different types of cancers, not just colorectal, not just pancreatic, not just breast, not just ovarian. Like, that's a huge swath already. And even within those types of tumors, it's not going to crop up in every single one of them, but it is going to crop up in a lot of them. And so finding something like that, that can be a common denominator between lots of different types of tumors, that's the type of target that you want. When you're trying to find not just a marketable, but also an effective drug for more patients, because you don't want it to be so hyper-specialized that it's only going to help one person. One person's important, but there's more commonalities between tumors, even across subtype.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, you want to be smart about it and maximize the effectiveness of whatever you're developing.
Yeah, like just the breadth. Yeah, maximize your reach, right, with your option. And so PD-1 is the one that Jim Allison, for example, made. That marker is present a lot of immune cells are exhausted and will express PD-1 on their cell surface in response to lots of cancers. And so this antibody that blocks it helps kind of stop T cells from being exhausted and helps them reactivate. And the reason for that is because cancers will upregulate a lot of the ligand for PD-1. They'll put something on their surface that will bind to an exhaustion marker and tell the T cell to turn off, tell immune cells to turn off.
You know, right? Nora, I think me and James and our audience would appreciate a little bit of like a basic lesson in how this all works as far as like the immune response.
I know, it's so hard to.
I have lots of questions.
Yeah.
it's hard. So something I did in grad school was, it's tough to talk about it, even to my committee, it was kind of difficult to get into the nitty gritty of it. I think there's kind of lots of levels to address the idea of immunotherapy. And so like the level that I've done a lot of in science communication work that I did in graduate school was relating it to Star Wars, because people.
Star Wars.
Yeah. So it's difficult to talk about. I mean, we've made a lot of strides in cancer treatment over the past few decades, and they've been really big jumps. You know, we've gone from this being a terminal disease for almost everybody who gets it to somebody can be completely essentially cured and be NEC, you know, evidence of cancer for the rest of their life potentially. And so I think that jump and how immunotherapy plays into it is difficult to grasp when you get immediately into the details, and I know I'm the worst offender of this because it's my field. But the way that I would just try and describe it to layman's audiences at first was to say that, you know, I'm going to try and level with you using Star Wars. Just imagine for a moment, you know, your body is like the Star Wars universe, right? You've got cancer, and that's kind of like your big bad, right? Cancer is like Darth Vader. Although I will note that somebody took that analogy that I made and corrected it online and said Sir Palpatine would be a better analogy. And I was like, okay, we'll make it Sir Palpatine.
Okay, so cancer is Palpatine. It's not like the Death Star, but it's generally bad,
has a secret identity, wreaking havoc in your body, has a larger conspiratorial plan, right? Yeah. That's what a tumor is. And so your immune system is the Jedi. Like, they want to get in there and attack this problem, but they don't know what they don't know. They don't know the identity of Sir Pop. They don't know who's actually doing this.
They didn't realize that he was just hiding in the Galactic Republic that whole time.
Tumors in general, they do this in a lot of ways, specific nitty-gritty ways that we can get into if you want, but they do this very often. And so what ends up happening is that the Jedi who want to do good can do literally nothing. They're a very ineffective force because the tumor has a secret identity. And so what we're trying to do, right, because the rest of your body is like the rest of the universe, they have no idea what the hell's going on. And so what I'm trying to do as an immunotherapist is give the knowledge of the audience who's watching this film, right, back to your body. I'm trying to give this knowledge that we have, which is we can see it's Sir Palpatine. I don't know why you're so blind. Like, this is the threat. You need to get in there now, right? I'm trying to give that audience knowledge back to the Jedi so that they can get in there and do what they've been designed to do for who knows how many years of evolution, which is to attack things that don't serve it. When cells in your body go rogue, your body is constantly removing those threats because the body has a very delicate balance and ecosystem that it's a homeostasis, if you will, that it's trying to maintain. And so, you know, for example, when one cell, like when you're in the sun, UV exposure, 100% there's DNA damage in some of those cells that have been exposed to the sun, right? If one of them gets a little too out of control, it's not replicating its DNA quite right, it's making lots of mistakes, your immune system knows it. And it will go in there and it will target that cell for removal. If it's not caught by the cell itself, the cell isn't realizing that it's making mistakes and so it won't self-destruct, your immune system will intervene and be like, this is a team effort. You don't get to go rogue, right?
Do tumors form when that gets out of control, or is it just the immune system loses track, or what happens there?
So like you'll have a cell, maybe it makes a mistake. It's replicating some DNA, one gene, it misses something or inserts something or it changes one amino acid to something else. And then that dominoes. The more mistakes you make, the easier it is to make mistakes, especially when you're making mistakes in machinery that control whether or not a cell lives or dies, right? And so what you see in a lot of tumor cells is that they will have gotten rid of a lot of their kind of self-destruct checks and balances. They'll mutate them. And so what ends up happening is that now they're not killing, you know, they're not that, you know, self-regulating anymore. And they're going to continue making more and more mistakes because a lot of those checkpoints are not being utilized because they've either been mutated or changed in some way. There are any gene you can think of realistically can be mutated, and any one of them could create the domino that leads to cancer. Sometimes a cell will make a mistake and it never becomes a tumorous cell. It never gets out of control. But once it does, once it accumulates either the right mistake or enough number of them, it will start proliferating, growing a tumor, right? And there's nothing to stop it from doing that. And more, except for the immune system, once the cells themselves are bad at regulating themselves, right? And so then you'll have the immune system come in and be like, this is a team effort. You don't get to do that. And they will start signaling to each other and to the rest of the body to target those cells for removal, right?
Right.
They
will the start. Immune system will.
Yeah. However, lots of tumor cells will have mistakes or create mistakes in different genes that allow for the suppression of the immune system. And so they will create signals that will tell the immune system to turn off. So even if the immune system came in, right, and did a little drive-by of a tumor, right, on its checks, because the immune system is constantly running checks all over your body at all times. and then it will meet up in lymph nodes and give the information to your lymph nodes of what's going on, right? If there's a problem, it will tell the lymph nodes where lots of other immune cells are recruited, right, for those same check-ins. And they'll be like, we got a problem in this sector, go over there. It's kind of like Osmosis Jones. It's almost exactly like that. So, you'd be like, we got a problem in this sector, go over there. Like when you get a paper cut, what do you think is causing inflammation, right? You get jabbed. This is actually something we said in my immunology class. You get jabbed with a pointy stick. What happens? The first thing that happens is that like your body is sending out signals of something is wrong. It's following suit, you know, immune cells that are already there who are kind of doing their little rounds, kind of like an RA doing little rounds, are like, ooh, we got a problem over here. One of them will go to the lymph node and be like, we have a problem over there. You got to go over there. And so that's how you get redness, inflammation. Like that's how you get recruitment into it of immune cells into an area to address a problem, right? The same thing happens for tumors, but then they'll release these factors that turn your immune system off. And so when they're doing those rounds to check in, they don't see anything. That's that smokescreen. That's that, oh, it's Sir Palpatine. He's doing something really bad, but you can't see because there's a closed door, right?
How does your immunotherapy react differently than the immune system, though?
So it's not reacting differently. And so in the case of my dissertation research, one of those mutations will secrete a signal that turns the immune system off. It's a metabolite. It's kynurenine. And so that metabolite is out in the extracellular space. A T cell sees it, eats it, and gets turned off. It gets the signal to, oh, there's nothing to see here. Keep moving. Keep it moving. There's nothing wrong here, right? And that's the thing. When we get rid of that metabolite enzymatically, we're depleting it with a protein. A human protein is the drug that we worked on that will degrade it into something that you can pee out. Non-toxic products. Then that signal doesn't exist anymore. And so that T cell that would normally get exhausted or normally get told to turn off will see the tumor and be like, we have to get in there. There's something wrong here.
Let's just go through this one more time, kind of piece by piece, a little slowly, because I think this is interesting. This is kind of like a little nugget that I want to learn.
I feel like I'm not doing a great job of explaining.
No, you're doing really great. I mean, this is a really complicated topic. So I want to make sure that, you know, kind of if need be, we repeat ourselves so we don't miss anything.
Cut the benefits.
Okay, so T cell.
Okay.
Is a T cell a Jedi?
Yeah.
Okay,
oh
great.
Oh my God. I didn't realize we had to go that far back. Okay. So the Jedi are all of your immune system. And your immune system is made up of lots of different types of cells. And so you've got T cells, which are my favorite, T for terrific. B cells, right? B cells make antibodies. They're all the rage right now because of the vaccine. And what we want is an antibody response from a vaccine, right? So B cells, also a Jedi. Not necessarily the Jedi I care about, but they're Jedi. We all have different colored lightsabers.
Yeah.
And then you've got antigen presenting cells. Don't get hung up on that word just yet. They have little hats. They show all the other cells what's going on. And those are things like dendritic cells, macrophages. Macrophages are the hungry hippos of the immune system. That was a real thing written in a figure at one point that I read. And so that's not exhaustive of all the different, of all the variety of immune cells you can kind of have. But that's a quick snapshot of the team we have assembled. There's lots of different types of T cells, lots of different types of B cells. There's multiple types of different macrophages and dendritic cells, but that's
right.
Basic setup.
Full disclosure, everything that we'll hear is probably like the very basic version. Any biochemist would be like, this is not detailed enough.
No, I think only an immunologist would be like, that's not quite right. but I think that's your basic setup, right? But
your basic players. Understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are your major players. And so those are your Jedi, right? And then tumor cells, we're just going to call the conglomerate of them a tumor Sir Palpatine because, millions and millions of Sir Palpatines feels really overwhelming. So so those are kind of your big bads. Nobody knows who they are. Your immune system certainly sometimes doesn't know what a tumor is, or if it did, it will get in there and it will just get exhausted fighting something that it can't defeat. And so it'll just kind of sit there and be, the word for it is anergic in the field, right? It just can't respond anymore. It's done all it can.
Is it because the tumor is like growing too fast and it can't, it can't destroy it at a fast enough rate?
In a sense, it's also like it just gets overstimulated. So if you got a lot of one signal, so a lot of immune cells require, especially T cells, is really what I'm speaking of, require more than one type of signal in order to be genuinely stimulated. And so if it's not getting this other signal, it's only getting the problem, right? Because one of the signals is that's a tumor cell. I know that that's not right, right? The other signal has to be activate, proliferate, do something, anything, right? And so, and that's to make sure that your immune system isn't overreacting to every single thing it sees. Otherwise, we'd all have autoimmunity, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need to have a genuine signal. That threshold is important for normal immunoregulation. But in tumors, it can lead to lots of immune cells getting exhausted at the front line because they will try and respond. Cancer cells are giving them lots of stimuli, but not the appropriate stimuli to actually activate against it. And so they just get exhausted and they sit still, right? They can't throw anything else at it. Some of those signals, like kynurenin, when they're eliminated, allow for T cells to reactivate because they're not getting a control signal from the tumor cell anymore. We're getting rid of that. And it allows them to be like, oh, I can do something. Great. I'm going to go do it now. It's a very delicate balance. It's a very delicate balance. One thing can kind of set it off. So I think that's probably the building blocks is you've got the Jedi, you've got your tumor. It wants to react.
There was another word that you were using, metabolites. You were using the word metabolites for a while.
You said that kynurenin is a metabolite.
Yeah, kynurenin is a metabolite.
I'd be interested in both the definition metabolite and kynurenin.
Oh boy. A metabolite in this. Okay, we're gonna take one step back. it's a reaction of a nutrient pathway essentially in the body, and so in this case, you have a lot of essential amino acids that you need to eat in order to survive, right? Essential amino acids, people have them when they're doing their like macro calculations and micronutrient calculations for weight loss or for fitness. Tryptophan is one of them. Tryptophan, you have to eat to get. Your body doesn't make it naturally.
Isn't that what makes you tired after you eat turkey?
It sure does. And the reason for that is related to one of two pathways that tryptophan goes through. In the body. And so when you eat tryptophan, two things are going to happen to it. It's either going to go through the serotonin pathway, the notably more famous pathway, even though it only takes up about 10% of consumed tryptophan. Only 10% of all the tryptophan you eat goes through the serotonin pathway. That's the bit that makes you feel tired after you eat. And actually most of the serotonin, even though we think about it as a neurological signal, which of course it is, actually most of that serotonin is created in your gut, not in your brain from tryptophan. And it goes there after. And so the other 90 to 95% of tryptophan is going to be used through the kynurenin pathway, that metabolite. And so the first step of tryptophan use in that pathway is converting it from tryptophan to kynurenin. Uh-huh. Kynurenin is a relatively stable intermediate, which is to say it won't completely change conformation, like go down to the next step on its own. Enzymes take it through the rest of the pathway. What ends up happening at the end of kynurenin is you make an essential cofactor called NAD, which is critical and essential for electron transport in your cells. And that's the big takeaway from tryptophan, is that you need it to have effective electron transport. It sounds kind of boring, but as a former biochemist and a classical synthetic organic chemist, this is essential. You need effective electron transport in your cells. And so NAD is one of the cofactors that help with that. And kynurenin is just one step from tryptophan to that final product. In fact, it's the first step. But when you make too much of it, like when IDO gets mutated in a cancer cell, you have more of it than your cells can naturally turn over. And so what ends up happening is that it makes so much of it that it leaves the cell because diffusion. Right? Like you got to go somewhere where there's less of it. There's too much of it for the cell to use. And so it leaves in tumor cells. And that's where it's allowed to interact with immune cells. More specific things happen than that. But that's the gist, is that typically you eat tryptophan, typically kynurenin will go down into NAD in the pathway. No harm, no foul. Everything's working well. When tumor cells in this particular instance mutate IDO or its sister TDO, two different enzymes that can mediate this reaction, that metabolite gets turned over a lot higher in higher quantity than usual. And that's where it's allowed to act as a signaling molecule for other cells.
Got it. So to take it back to immunotherapy for a second. So it sounds like immunotherapy, gosh, I don't even know what immunotherapy sounds like. I want you to say what it is. But just, you know, so it sounds like it's acting on some of these pathways, right? Or adding markers for your immune system. So can we take it back there and kind of go full circle now?
Yeah. So basically we're trying, it's going to use a substance that could be an enzyme like I did in grad school. It can be literal T cells infusions, which is what I'm doing now at my company. And it is giving something to your body to stimulate your immune system to help it fight cancer, infection, other diseases. In my case, it's cancer. That's what I'm most qualified to speak on.
So it can be used for non-cancerous.
Absolutely. Okay. I just don't work in that field. There's much smarter people working on that. But I work on it in the scope of cancer, which is relevant to lots of other types of fields. So something we learn in cancer might be relevant for people working in autoimmunity, especially when we're talking about immunotherapy, right? Because we're trying to modulate the immune system. And so things that we learn in cancer help inform a lot of other types of fields. Actually, when I was working on kynurenine, that metabolite, you know, it's used to suppress your immune system against cancer, right? If you were to replace the word tumor with fetus, it's almost exactly the same mechanism. And that's like my favorite thing about kynurenine, is that it's used in pregnancy to stop the immune system from attacking a fetus in the first stage.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. And women, unfortunately, who have a problem generating this kynurenine at the fetal-maternal interface, have difficulties maintaining a pregnancy past the first trimester. They'll miscarry often because the immune cells are getting triggered by this foreign DNA. They're like, that doesn't belong there. What is that? There's lots of things that contribute to that protection for the development of a fetus, but that kynurenine is one of them. And it's almost exactly the same mechanism as it is in tumors. It's just being co-opted in this negative context, the positive one.
So kind of what does the horizon look like then for immunotherapy? Like, how far have we come and how far do we still have to go?
I think we've come really far in a very short amount of time. I think that there was kind of, for a long time, people didn't even really think that immune modulation for cancer was even the answer to cancer treatment. They're like, this is kind of nonsense. This isn't going to be the way that we do it. It was only really in like the 90s that it was starting to pick up steam. And that's partially because we were able to learn more about immune cells. Like, we just didn't know very much about immune cells up until that point. And then less than a decade later, by like the mid, like before 2010, 2000s, you're getting the first clinical trials of antibodies that will stimulate your immune system against cancer. And now we have approved immunotherapies for cancer that are in people that are changing and hopefully saving their lives, and more to come. Like our company, for example, just submitted an application to begin a clinical trial for a T cell based immunotherapy. And so the first people are being enrolled in it right now. So, you know, it's definitely happening very fast. I think it's hard to see that when you're in it, because it kind of feels, or even if you're all the way on the other end, if you're completely outside of it, because you're like, well, immunotherapy is not what's going to happen when I take a loved one to the hospital. But the truth is that it might.
And I think that's an interesting thing for me to think about. Like, where it's currently at is like, if God forbid some family member has cancer, more than likely immunotherapy isn't widespread enough to where that would be the first treatment that they would get, right? Like, it's not quite that ubiquitous, right? But maybe it will be soon.
It's not accessible. This is not really a science opinion. This is more of like a socioeconomic opinion. This is a personal opinion, to be sure. It's just also just not accessible to a lot of people. I think that it should be, but it's just not, right?
To me, it seems less invasive than a lot of the other options as well. So I think on the patient front, I think it'll be quite popular there.
It sounds nice that they're getting zapped with radiation, personally.
So, or poisoning your body with chemo.
That's kind of the reason people were moving in this direction. Like, they could see that patients were experiencing horrible side effects. I've seen those side effects of chemotherapy and radiation. And it, I mean, because the truth is that it's kind of a competition with your normal cells. Like, how sick can we make you to get rid of the thing that's making you sick? And will it be enough, right? Whereas with immunotherapy, you're like, can we just train your immune system to do what it's meant to do? Because like I said, your immune system already knows how to eliminate rogue players. It just needs to do that over and over and over and over again for a super cell.
Just needs a little help.
Yeah, it just needs a little bit of a boost, right? And so that's what the immunotherapy hopefully will do. And it won't come with as many side effects. I think the biggest side effects that we, you know, that we see both at my job and also just in the field are kicking up an immune response and then not being able to taper it back down. And so something that happened with anti-CTLA-4 therapy, a good example, I was seeing this in a conference, was a breast cancer patient, I believe, had anti-CTLA-4 therapy and it cured her breast cancer. Her immune system successfully cleared out her breast cancer. But she has diabetes now because of autoimmunity, because like she bumped up her immune system so much, it started attacking normal cells, right? And so I remember I asked this question actually in the meeting. I was like, is there any way to get rid of that? Because I was younger at the time. I was like, what, do we want that? Is that okay? And I remember the answer I got was very, fair. He was like, if I had to choose, I would choose diabetes over cancer. And I was like, all right, that's fair. Maybe that was a dumb question. But you know what I mean? I think that those are kind of the biggest problems, is if you're going to ramp it up, you need to be able to tone it back down. And that is actually, you know, it's kind of orthogonal to what I worked on in my dissertation research, right? I worked in a mechanism that tapers your immune system down. How can we eliminate it so that we can ramp it back up on its own kind of naturally? Whereas a lot of immunotherapies are introducing signals. Like, we're getting rid of a signal. Lots of immunotherapies are introducing a signal to allow for T cell, mostly, stimulation against cancer. And so toning that back down is a huge concern. That would be true if you were using antibodies, like in the anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1 case, or with CAR TCR immunotherapies, which is what I work on now, which are basically infusing patients with T cells that have markers on them to attack the cancer. Like, they, like, directly from the patient, you will take T cells.
I have a question. How do you generally test before you go on like human trials that this will even work? Like, do you test on mice? Are you able to just simulate this and have a pretty good idea?
That's a great question. So I've been actually a part of that, both through my dissertation work and now on the in vitro end of that preclinical trial for my job. And there's lots of ways to test if something's going to kind of work, and whether or not it'll be safe before it ever goes into a person. The first is obviously mouse models. And so for an there are ways to do it without an immune competent, which is to say a perfectly normal mouse has its own immune system doing everything on its own. That's what we used for my enzymatic depletion strategy. We wanted a fully immune competent mouse because we wanted to see what the immune system would do if we gave our drug, right? Yeah.
So a mouse like without cancer, just give a healthy mouse this treatment.
So you give a healthy mouse cancer.
We can do that?
So you give a healthy mouse a mouse cancer, which a lot of mouse cancer, well, maybe not all of them, but some of them typically are actually done by giving radiation to mice or giving them toxins until they create their own cancers. And then you create cell lines from those to be able to give to mice. And so I worked in lots of different mouse tumor models, and basically you would give them a cancer, like give them a tumor. You would give them cancer cells, it would create a tumor. And then you would inject your treatment into them and see if it works. That would be your preclinical assessment of whether or not your idea is even right. And two things need to happen. Three things need to happen. One, you can't kill the mouse by just giving your treatment in comparison to a control. So if you kill the mouse just because you gave treatment, dead in the water.
Not going to go very far.
Not going in a person ever. Probably not going into a mouse anymore either. The second thing, and you know, I say dead is like a binary, but it's also the general health of the mouse. So if there's some weird side effect that happens in the mouse just from giving treatment, I mean, it's almost entirely dead in the water. The second thing is you need to make sure that it works. So that means in comparison to control, you see a decrease in tumor size or clearance of a tumor. Alternatively, in the control, you'd probably see a tumor get bigger and bigger and bigger up until the point where you have to end the experiment because it's inhumane past a certain point. The third thing that needs to happen that you need to validate is if it works for the reason you think it does.
Oh.
Because if it doesn't work for the reason you think it does, there's no way it's going into a person.
That's fair.
So a good example of that is actually in our work, we used a human enzyme and a bacterial enzyme to deplete this metabolite that we're interested in, right? Now, the human enzyme would be great for people because it is human and your body's not going to be as angry as it would be if it was foreign. Because like we talked about now, immune systems are designed to attack things that are foreign, right? And so if it sees a bacterial enzyme, just like if it saw a bacteria, like an actual bacterial infection, it will attack it. It will be like, get rid of it. We don't need it. It's not us, right? And so in the case of our bacterial enzymes, one of the things that we needed to establish, especially because it was our proof of concept enzyme, it just had better activity, was if the mouse treatment, like the mice that we were treating, were responding, its immune system was responding because of our strategy, because of this depletion of kynurenine, or if it was responding because it was a bacterial enzyme and that's going to boost your immune system because it's foreign.
Oh.
Right? And so the way that you do that, for example, is you would boil your enzyme for one as an extra control. Boil your enzyme until it's not active anymore. Inject that into a mouse as a separate control arm. Because if you have an inactive enzyme but and you still have an immune response, it's just responding to the fact that it's bacterial.
Interesting.
Right? But if it doesn't have an effect, which it doesn't, it's your mechanism that is causing a response. And then on top of that, you need to show that the response you're getting is immune cell related. And so from there, you take out the tumor and you actually run analysis on the tumor to see if there's more T cells, B cells, dendritic cells in that tumor sample than there were in the controls, right? Do you see an infiltration or not? Do you see them more activated or not? There are biomarkers that can tell you if they're more activated, if they're more suppressed. Do you see those?
Remarkable. So like you would take out a tumor and if it worked, you would see it, say, flooded with T cells or immune cells. And then you would say, aha, clearly there is an immune response here.
Flooded is a strong word, but yes, essentially, yes. But yeah, I think you would. And actually, there was a collaborator who I love at UT that worked with us, Dr. Lauren Ehrlich. She's the best in the game. She talks about T cells, like everything about them is incredibly obvious. She's so brilliant. But she used to actually take slices of the tumor for us. And you could actually see through microscopy, like her lab would do this because this is just something she's like her lab is good at. You could actually see more T cells at the margin of tumors that got our treatment versus the dead, quiet darkness of tumors that get control treatment. And even inside the tumors, which is notoriously difficult to get into, solid tumors are very difficult to penetrate, you would see immune cells recruited in there when given our treatment, which is great. That's a huge deal. So that kind of shows you that it works in mice. And then there's lots of in vitro characterization, in vitro meaning in a dish, not in an animal. In vivo would be in an animal. Ex vivo would be taken out of the animal, right? So you do something in the animal, you take it out and evaluate it further. And so in vitro, which is at the bench, there's lots of tissue culture techniques you can use to make sure that it's not dangerous to people. In the case of immunotherapies that are cell-based, that's really important. You don't want cells that you're going to give to a person hurting other cells that are not their target, right? Because ideally, if you have, you know, a CAR or TCR-based therapy for T cells, they should only attack things that express either the antigen or the full marker that they're targeting in cancer. And so your normal liver cells shouldn't have it. Your normal cardiomyocytes, your heart cells shouldn't have it. And so what you do is you actually culture-induce pluripotent stem cells that have been differentiated to create these different types of cells, like normal cells in your body, cardiomyocytes, hepatocytes, microglia, which are like brain resident immune cells, basically. We haven't even gotten to microglia. We won't. It'll take forever. oh my God. Lots of different types of neurons to make sure it's not affecting your neurophysiology. And then you'll give your cells, for example, like your immunotherapy, in my case at work, it's cell-based. you'll give those to those different cells and see if any of them die. Hmm. They shouldn't. Only tumor cells should die, right? Okay. You'll culture those as a control, but you have to make sure.
You have little petri dishes of these different...
Essentially, cells. Yeah. You have like you give plate all these cells and you hope that you're not off target, basically. That's the most you can do, is make sure that you're not affecting other cells that are not your target cells, right? In the case of, you know, the enzyme strategy, right? It's kind of hard to say if you could do that. We don't see it because we're using immune competent mice. We know that it's not toxic, right? It's not killing the mouse, right? But a lot of models in mice sometimes are nude, which means that they don't have an active immune system, or something about them is very different, right? Like if you have a genetically engineered mouse. And so it's good to do the extra step, because you want to make sure that what you're seeing in a mouse that is not really complete is comparable to what you see in a complete organism, right? Because most people are not immunocompromised, if that makes sense, or have an intact immune system.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Kind of lots of different steps. Lots of measures are in place to make sure that safety is met as a bare minimum standard for anything that goes into a person. That happens before it ever sees a clinical trial. There's lots of things to make sure that it won't hurt your body, and it won't only attack.
And just one more question, one more question along this thread. But like, how, and maybe a better way to say this would be like, what is a normal day like at work for you or someone in this field look like, as far as when you're designing this stuff, you know, what kind of tools do you use in these sciences in general?
I guess this is definitely one of those things where you're so specialized now that you can't fathom other people not using the same tools as you. But that is a great question, because in reality, my day-to-day looks super different from an architect or an engineer. Yeah.
Or a physicist or anything.
Or a physicist, yeah. So I'm trying to pick like highlight. I already know one of them. I think my favorite tool is definitely the Fortessa, which is a flow cytometer. A flow cytometer is my bread and butter. So a flow cytometer is a machine that will allow you to analyze the phenotype, or the way, the identification, the biomarker characterization of cells using fluorophores. And so you
flow cytometer
stain cells with antibodies to the markers that you're interested in, conjugated to a fluorophore, so it will light up when it's excited, have a certain emission. And then you do that, and then you look at what their identity is on a flow cytometer. And so let's say that I'm interested in looking for T cells, right? In a mashed up tumor sample that I've already processed, right?
Right.
I'll stain it for certain T cell markers. So allow me to get into some alphabet soup, like CD3 or CD4 or CD8. And so I'll look for some of these very basic markers for T cells, and I will see whether or not they appear in my sample on a flow cytometer, because they are stained for those markers.
So you're mostly just like in a lab surrounded by beakers and pipettes? Are you like on a computer?
I do some. I definitely do a lot of computer work, just because analyzing that type of data takes a long time.
So you do lab work and analysis then?
Oh yeah, there is no other way. There is only that way. If you're at the bench, you're also at the desk, because you have to analyze that data. And so I'll do like where I'm surrounded by pipettes, by lots of specialized different types of culture plates. There is a culture plate for everything you can think of. Every single thing, lots of different types of media. Let me tell you, neurons, different type of media than every other type of media. They don't like the same type of media. T cells have their own specialized media. You can't give T cells just anything. Tumor cells are pretty hardy. You could probably put tumor cells in spit and they grow.
Media meaning what they're grown in?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Growth medium. Yeah. So like the liquid that they are growing in. It has lots of different nutrients in it, amino acids. Sometimes they have soluble factors that will support their growth. And so in T cells, for example, you typically add something called IL-2, and that will help T cells proliferate. It's a proliferation signal that is normally used in your body to help T cells proliferate. lots of different types of media, pipettes, lots of different types of machines. My favorite is the flow cytometer. All the flow cytometers at UT, at least in my department, because of the man who maintains them, Richard, are named after Star Trek characters. And so Kirk was the one that I worked with most often, and we had a relationship, Kirk and I. I was at that flow cytometer often. but yeah, that's probably the big one for me, but there's lots of machines people use. I end up being in a biosafety cabinet most of my day. So there's chemical hoods that I think some people who have ever taken a chemistry lab are familiar with. Most people who've taken a biology lab don't typically have to work in a biosafety cabinet. And that's kind of the reverse of a chemical hood. So a chemical hood is kind of sucking air in so you're not breathing in all of these nasty chemicals, right? Whereas a biosafety cabinet is taking air, filtering it, and pushing it into the hood to make sure that it is sterile at all times. A biosafety cabinet is sterile 100% of the time because it needs to be for effective culture.
Interesting. So it keeps everything sterile so you don't get like unwanted.
No contamination. Oh, contamination. That's your big no-no anywhere in this field. Contamination's the devil, because if you get contamination in your tumors, for example, you would think that wouldn't even be a big problem. It's like, yeah, it's big and bad. Who cares? If you have a contamination in your tumor and then you put that tumor into a mouse, how do you know that what you gave that mouse is representative of the tumor that you think it is, right? Even if you culture tumor cells for too long, you can change, like tumor cells are, even when they're culturing, they can change genetically. And so if you culture something for too long and you're not paying attention, you just keep splitting them, keeping them alive. After what, 100 times splitting them, they're not even the same line anymore. Mm-hmm. They're completely different. So I think weird technicalities. They seem very secondhand to me, but I get that they're not. And in fact, that didn't come naturally either. They weren't secondhand even as I started graduate school, because in graduate school, I didn't actually do any tissue culture up until that point. And I learned lots of things the hard way in that situation, because I had to kind of teach myself a lot of those techniques. What a mess. Figuring out how tricky it is, figuring out what you need to do and what you don't need to do, the corners you can cut and which ones you absolutely shouldn't.
I'm finding it so fascinating, Nora, talking to you, because as you pointed out, you're so specialized and in depth into this, and like
everything you've said is useless for our audience because nobody can understand it.
Well, what I was thinking was like you obviously have gone through extensive training and like dare I say, like you're dedicating your life to this, and like thank goodness that there's people like you. Probably you have a whole company full of people like you, I would imagine. You want to take us through just a little bit, like what your training looked like and kind of how you arrived where you are?
Sure. So I started as an astrobio major at Florida Tech, which is where we all met. And I was an astrobio major because I wanted to do, like, ever since I was little, I wanted to work for NASA, and I wanted to work in like astronaut kind of physiology and health. So I wanted to figure out how the body works in space. And so when I came to FIT, that was the primary reason behind it. I knew that it was close to NASA, and I knew that I would have an opportunity maybe to work in that type of research. After being there for a semester, I decided that I kind of wanted to get a more classical training in it. Astrobiology is a very hyper-specialized undergrad degree. And I thought, I have a lot of time to become hyper-specialized. This is probably not going to be the time for me to do that.
So grad school is a good time for hyper-specialization.
It's the time out of for everybody who goes to grad school. But I think at the time as an undergrad, I really wanted to get a feel for what I liked and what I didn't. I knew that I was very interested in space, but I always knew that I wanted to be in kind of the biophysics side of it, which is nothing like what I do now, but at the time that's what I wanted to do. So I switched into biochem as my major, worked in a synthetic organic chem lab, which had also nothing to do with what I originally went to school hoping for, but it was very fun. And then I did an internship in molecular biology. That was the first time I'd ever done bio like related research in a way that reminds me of my grad school research. That was the first time I'd ever done anything like that. And it was a large reason why I was kind of leaning towards that field in the end. Came back, did some work in Alzheimer's, actually with another person that you interviewed, Wade, in the same lab. And then I did another internship in environmental biomaterials, where we magnetically modified a seaweed that was absorbent of water soluble dyes to help like decrease pollution in textile heavy regions.
Magnetically modified it?
Yeah, so you would bind iron nanoparticles to it. It was actually really elegant. The way that they did this in this lab in the Czech Republic, in Chuck Schneebel's lab, was they would literally microwave iron nanoparticles to Posidonia seaweed, and it would bind the iron nanoparticles to it. And then when you put them in water that has lots of dye, it will just suck all the dye out because the seaweed is naturally adsorbent. And they're like, this is really great, because the big problem with a lot of environmental remediation projects is that once you introduce something to get rid of the pollutant, you can't get the thing that you put in out, right? Whereas this is a solid floating seaweed that is now magnetically modified, so you can literally capture it all.
That is really cool.
Yeah, it was really fun. And so I did that for a summer, and then I came back, did my senior thesis in Dr. Grimwade's lab in Florida, at Florida Tech, which was another kind of molecular genetics oriented project based on like replication at ORI C of E. coli. And at that point, I kind of already knew that I wanted to kind of go the mole bio route, something similar to my internship, my first internship. And I chose UT for lots of reasons, but mostly because I thought I would be happiest in Austin, and it had a multitude of professors I would be happy to work with. And so I ended up going to UT, settled on my lab, which did enzyme engineering for cancer research. And so there's a joke in my lab, my former lab, that you could pick any amino acid and do a dissertation on it, because every amino acid is differentially used by tumor cells. Like, their nutritional needs are so different from normal cells. And if you wanted to start with any reading on that topic, you would start with Warburg, who first proposed that tumor cells need more sugar than normal cells. And everybody laughed at him. And but yeah, so they just have much different nutritional needs. And so typically the way that our enzyme engineering worked in that lab is you would pick an amino acid, you would pick the enzyme that is in the pathway of that amino acid, you would engineer it to degrade it, because your normal cells typically have backups or redundancies for them that tumor cells don't. But that's not really quite how mine worked. Kynurenine is a little bit different, because kynurenine is not a nutritional need. It's just a byproduct of an essential amino acid that turns immune cells off. And that's what makes it an immunotherapeutic strategy versus anything else, right? Because it's something that we're doing to modulate the immune system, right? That's like the that's the reason it's efficacious. And so that's what I did for my dissertation research. I did originally enzyme engineering for this drug. And then between me and the efforts of a couple other people in the lab on that project, we stumbled on an enzyme that was actually pretty good at doing what we wanted it to. That was human. And so from there, I kind of had a choice. I could pivot to a new enzyme and do a completely different second project, or I could do more work on the kynurenine pathway, more work on why our drug works. And that's what I decided to do, because kynurenine is used in tons of immune regulation paths. It's used in, you know, it's manipulated by tumor cells to turn your immune system off, but it's also used to control infection, because every time your immune system turns on, you have to turn it back off. Otherwise, you would get a fever from a paper cut, which is not desirable.
Not good.
And so that's something that kynurenine is very good at, right? It's one of the many signals that your body uses to turn your immune system off a little bit. And so it's used in infection. It's used in your gut to support healthy microbiomes. Like, it's used in pregnancy to protect the fetus in the first trimester. And actually, the more you go, what's the word I'm looking for? The more you're pregnant, the longer you're pregnant, the more kynurenine you have to protect the fetus even more. Actually, my friend Helen is pregnant right now with her first child. And the way that she told me was through my thesis. She highlighted the part where I was talking about kynurenine.
Oh my God.
And she sent me an edit back with just one edit. And it just had that part highlighted. And it said, my kynurenine levels are high right now. And I was like, oh my God. fingers crossed.
You speak the same language.
But yeah, once I had kind of done that, and I was particularly interested in this pathway because nobody really knew what it did to T cells. Like, we knew that kynurenine affected T cells. We could see that in our mouse model. We could see that mice that were given our treatment had more T cells at the tumor than ones that didn't. And so we're like, oh, so it's bringing in T cells. Awesome. Great. We're great at this game. Done. We're done here, right? And that would be enough, honestly, to move forward out of preclinical development and go into maybe like a more company startup oriented development before it hits a clinical trial. But as an academic, and certainly for my thesis, I was more interested in what specifically it is doing to those T cells to change them. That's not information you necessarily need. That's information that's great to have going into a clinical trial.
Interesting.
And so there's two main different types of T cells. There's a CD8 positive and CD4 positive, like you mentioned at the beginning. And CD8s are the ones that people love to see because they can actively kill tumor cells. Like they can do it all by themselves. Once they see it and they're activated, it's over, right? Whereas CD4s are like helpers. They can be lots of different types of helpers, but they are helpers. And they're not typically the goal. The goal is obviously to like destroy tumor cells. But without CD4s, that becomes very difficult. And that's why I thought that they were really important. And so the CD4 story on my end of the dissertation was the part that I spent the most time on because, and this is true, kynurenin, the way that it operates in infection and pregnancy it's not only about CD8s. It's not just about this one part of T cells. It's about that other huge compartment that it's changing. And through my work, I was able to kind of hone in on what changes this metabolite kynurenin was making to CD4 positive T cells, how it makes them more regulatory, how it makes them more suppressive. So not only are tumor cells stopping CD8, something that would come in there and kill them, not only is it turning them off, but it's changing other T cells to support tumor growth. It is changing them to their side and making them suppressive.
Which of course is very important for us to know. I would assume, right? As we try to gain more knowledge about how these pathways work, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that changes. It changes the way that we kind of. It not only changes the way that we would treat certain things because we're knowing what's activated, what's not, what's changing, what's not, but it also helps us get more information about the way that this pathway is used in other contexts, and especially in the case of kynurenin. Maybe in cancer, you care most about the CD8 positive killer T cells, cytotoxic T cells. But in autoimmunity, you care a lot about CD4s. And so knowing what is happening there is really critical to maybe co-opting some of that information and using it in a different way to help a different type of patient, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I do in my dissertation. And then when I was looking for jobs, oh, cat number two. And so that's what I kind of did.
Did you know you wanted to go to like a company as opposed to a university? How was that?
I applied for postdocs and jobs. This year's been kind of different. I started the year knowing that I wanted to graduate in 2020. I knew like I had a personal goal of writing and finishing defending my thesis before the end of this year. Mm-hmm. But lots of things changed. Like we go into lockdown in March. Yeah.
So you wanted to end in 2020, not knowing what 2020 would be.
Yeah. I didn't really know what was going to happen, right? On crystal ball. So we went into lockdown.
I believe it was March 15th or so that I went into lockdown. James, you remember that day?
I do.
I think it was like March 8th or something for me. It was like right after I got back. It was so crazy because actually my friend and I had gone on a trip to Mobile, Alabama the week prior for Mardi Gras.
Back
and within a week, I did like 1 week of experiments and we were in lockdown. Froze everything, went into lockdown. And I think at first we were like, oh, maybe this only lasts a couple of weeks. And it became apparent that this was not going to be that temporary. And so in April, I was like, so should I start writing? Hmm. Are we going to move forward without everything that we wanted? Right.
So you had to kind of stop your experimental work when the lockdown started?
Yeah. And actually, I had started writing, finished the bulk of the thesis by the end of May, beginning of June. And it was around the middle of June, I was starting the editing, like the massive editing process. I had already gone through 1,000 iterations of my intro at that point. But I started the editing process in earnest with my PI. And I said, I have samples that are frozen back and I would really like to run them. Mm. At the time at UT, the only people who were allowed for research were COVID related research, which we were doing at UT. Actually, the plasma, like the plasma infusion, the convalescent plasma therapy that people were using at the beginning to help people that had a really bad case of COVID, that came out of a UT Austin collaboration on my floor. Nice. And so I remember I just went to my boss and I was like, I'm begging you to work. I just need 1 week. Like, give me 1 week to get some repeats out. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, because you really just can't tell science when it's going to do what you want.
Yeah.
Or when it isn't. But it's worth trying, because if we do this, then we'll be able to actually run the stats on these figures for my thesis. And that would make it so much stronger. Like, having a repeatable, important experiment would be really good for me when I defend. And so I went in like the last week of June. This was about 3 weeks before I was going to defend. And I did the last like two experiments I was ever going to do as a grad student. Because we just weren't allowed back on campus. And so I did those experiments. They worked in a sign from the universe. I have never been that lucky. That was the first time.
So you had your 1 week window and it worked.
And it worked.
You got important data in that one week.
Important data. And so I incorporated it into the thesis at the end of July. I defended. And then the rest of August became me applying both for postdocs and jobs. I started with the job market first, just because postdocs are very competitive. I'm not deterred by that, but at the same time, you don't want just any postdoc, just like you wouldn't want just any assignment for grad school. You wouldn't want to be with the wrong mentor, or a mentor that doesn't want the same things as you, to be in just any lab. That's just not good for your career development. You want to have a very compatible relationship for both grad school and postdocs. And so in order to do that, that requires a tremendous amount of research. You wouldn't just have to know where you wanted to go. It's not like grad school where you'd apply to a school. You'd have to reach out specifically to professors if you wanted a postdoc appointment.
Are you able to be a little more flexible in the job search?
In what way?
Well, you said that the postdoc, you know, you want the exact match.
Right.
In the job search, do you also want the exact match, or is there a little more flexibility there?
It felt more flexible to me because I knew what kind of work I wanted to do. And so the interview process would suss out whether or not I'd be a good fit at a place or on a team, as opposed to me having to really commit to a type of project at the get-go, right? Because I think when I was applying for jobs, I knew that I wanted to stay in the immunology space, and I knew I wanted to stay in the T-cell space because I love T-cells. But I think I applied for both. Like, one of the postdocs that I applied for, which I was very excited about, even though it included a lot of mouse work, which I don't love doing. I've done a lot of mouse work, but I don't love it. It makes me feel kind of bad. And one of them was in Paris for somebody who does like a lot of tumor imaging.
Ooh.
Like, ooh, that would have been really cool.
Awesome.
But it's different. I think also culturally it's different. Like, when you apply for a job, especially in the biotech industry, the truth is is that you're compensated differently for your time than you would be as a postdoc, by a non-negligible amount. I think that that's an injustice that I think a lot of people in academia know, especially when you're on that level. When you're a grad student or a postdoc, you know how unfair it is, how little you get paid, and how little especially postdocs get paid. They have a PhD, and more often than not, they're making less than 50K, depending on what city they live in, which is upsetting. It's upsetting. And so I think there was definitely something to be said about that. And also just where you have the most opportunity to grow. Lots of academic institutions right now are still shut down, whereas biotech companies put COVID policies into place rapidly so that they could continue working. And so that's also a difference. That's just the type, you just don't have that kind of horsepower or that type of control over your individual lab at an academic institution. You know, universities decide those policies, not individual PIs, mm-hmm. right? And so I think there were lots of factors playing into it. What ended up happening is that I applied to both because I was open to both, as long as I got to continue doing science that I was excited about. And this was the opportunity that made me an offer. It was also really important that I got a job. I could have continued postdocing in the lab that I got my PhD in. But the truth is that because of COVID restrictions, I can't be prioritized to be in the lab. Just like it was my time to graduate in the summer, and so I was prioritized for that 1 week. It's younger students now who are in my lab who are hoping to graduate at the end of 2020 or the beginning of 2021. They have to be prioritized now for non-essential, quote unquote, lab work. And so you would just be kind of like sitting. Maybe that's like people's dream is just like sit and grab a paycheck. But for me, it was, I like being busy. You might remember that from our time at university. but I like being busy. And so that was not something I was looking forward to. I really wanted to get back in the lab. I felt very disconnected from science the longer I was out of the lab.
I think that makes sense. I mean, I personally knew that I wanted to go to like industry and had almost zero interest in going to university. So I wanted
the academic experience because I mean, I really like teaching and I love the idea of leading my own lab. Like, I think if I had my dream scenario, it would be a lot like a Florida Tech or a Rice. So one of my favorite actually situations of this is at Rice University in Houston. They're kind of perfectly positioned because they're quite small in comparison to UT, right? They're a little bit bigger than Florida Tech. They focus a lot on undergraduate education, so there's not like a huge postdoc culture there. And they're very close to Johnson Space Center. And so in my head, it was perfect. It's like, oh, I get to work in immunology, but then I can have some, you know, side projects with NASA. That would be great. That would be my ideal situation.
All right, we've got the vision now.
Yeah, there's definitely a vision. It's just, it's very hard to break into that. And, you know, just because you want to work at a university, for example, doesn't mean that they'll have a post for you at that time.
It's so competitive too, getting into those universities, like getting tenure track positions. It's so hard.
And I think there was definitely, the older I got in grad school, the more that insecurity didn't feel very alluring to me. Like, I think at first I felt very confident about it. And I was like, if I just hit it hard enough, like I will be fine. But the truth of it is that you're not really comfortable until you achieve tenure. And even then, you're not that comfortable if you don't have grants. Like, I think that was kind of, I saw kind of a lot of different sides of that through undergrad and grad school. Florida Tech and UT are really nothing alike, but, you know, I saw what it was like in labs that I've worked in where there was less funding than was needed to continue the science. And it sucked because everybody had very great ideas and it forced you to be more resourceful. But it kind of was a self-perpetuating cycle. If you don't have funding, you can't do the science, you need to get a publication. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a publication, you can't apply for grants to get any funding. And so that vicious cycle sets certain labs and environments up for failure before you ever really get into whether somebody has a good idea, right? At Florida Tech, it's going to sound kind of silly to say, but at Florida Tech, you know, if I wanted a $50 reagent, I needed to really explain myself. Like, why do I need a $50 reagent to do this chemistry? Can you be resourceful and use something that's on the bench, right? Whereas, you know, I went to my internship, for example, at Princeton, which was wild. And that was the first experience I had ever had with just an institution. The whole institution just has more money. It is older, right? It's an Ivy League.
Yeah, Ivy League school. So, I mean,
and so they were like, yeah, if it's under $5,000-$10,000, like it's virtually free. And I was like, I can't imagine that. And then in biotech, it's completely different. I mean, in biotech, it's that times 10, right? You're inundated with resources in biotech. It's completely different. Like, I joined my lab, my new job here at the end of October, and there were resources in that lab I had never even heard of. Like, we just didn't even have that machine. I'm learning machines that I didn't even know existed. Like, one of them allows you, it's called an Incusite, and it allows you to measure the proliferative capacity of two different cell types with two different dyes in real time, over time. So you could just like leave it in there and like see how things duplicate or don't. And I was like, that's my whole PhD.
And they have like one instrument.
Like, you have one machine that does everything I did basically for the later half of my PhD. That's, if I had that, that would have been that would have been the difference between me doing years of assay optimization versus just getting results.
You know what though? I'm sure people be having to be more resourceful in a more constrained environment, I'm sure that can help make them better scientists.
It definitely is. I felt that way, honestly, coming into grad school, because I felt like at FIT, undergrads were allowed to pursue undergraduate research pretty aggressively. Mm-hmm. And FIT also encouraged people to be resourceful with what they had on hand. And so what ended up happening is, like, I came into grad school and lots of people had lots of skills, but they didn't understand why things worked the way that they worked, which if you have to do it the old way or the hard way, is kind of your default. You have to understand why something works so right. that you can troubleshoot it when it fails. I think that there was a big difference there. I mean, even coming into my new work environment, there are people that are younger than me who came out of, you know, post-bac, who came out of bachelor's, and they've worked in this lab environment and exclusively a biotech lab environment. And so they're like, how do you count your cells? And I was like, you look at them. You look at them under a microscope and then you count with a little ticker. And she's just like, computer does it for us. And I was like, I feel like an old person telling a young person back in my day, we had to count by sight. But there are some benefits to it. I think that there are some things that I got to experience other people didn't, even something as simple as a kit. You know, we have lots of kits in molecular biology that will isolate DNA or, you know, do big preps of plasmids. And when I was in Florida Tech, we actually had to do an old school phenol chloroform extraction of our DNA, which is how the kit works. The kit is a variation of this old school way of doing it. But we had to do it that big way for very little yield. And I remember thinking, this is so pointless, but I understood how the kit worked and everybody else just uses the kit. It doesn't seem important until it is. And then, yeah, definitely different. Also, I'm horrified of centrifuges being imbalanced. That's also because of Florida Tech. But Dr. Colton impressed upon us that our legs were going to get chopped off if we had an imbalanced centrifuge. And I was like, this is just really very alarming.
Yeah, rattled the chocolate off the table.
One other big question, and we always want to try to get to this one, but this could be in your field or just for the world in general, but what gets you excited about the future and also concerned for you, Nora?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm very focused on my own vision. So I think like the thing that makes me really excited is kind of renewed interest in human spaceflight. And so I really like the idea that even private companies can get into that space. So I really like the idea of private companies like SpaceX reinvigorating that field. I think it means that in the future, NASA will also have more funding as a collaborator. Kind of like I said at the beginning, like it's always been my goal as a kid. And so that makes me really excited. I also just think that there's so much to learn from the different types of experiments. And so, you know, one of the things that's kind of popping right now, like I kind of got into immunotherapy on accident just as it was becoming really popular, right? It's becoming a really hot topic for people to utilize in the field and in medicine. Whereas in the future, I kind of see that going more like the bioenergetics route. Like how does the base metabolism of different cells change? That's going to be kind of the key to stress, age, disease related medicine advancements in the future, I think. And I think that space actually does that very well. Space research does that well because your cells are under a lot of different types of stress in space and microgravity. And it changes the base energetics, like the base metabolism of your cells. So for example, you're naturally more inflamed in space than you would be on Earth. Your immune cells tend to be a little compromised in space than they are on Earth. And learning why helps make advancements here. So actually one of my favorite things that NASA does every year is they do a big book basically of all the research they did and how it influenced stuff here, like on the ground. So not NASA related projects, not NASA related companies or advancements, but how their work influenced everybody else. And so like one time they did, they were doing biofuel research and they're like, oh wow, these cells, you know, this can really make a lot of this product, which was needed in baby formula. And so now baby formula is just complete because of NASA. Super random.
I just want to add a little perspective to this because this is kind of funny. So I'm the one who's just really excited about rockets and satellites and space flight. And often, like the International Space Station, continuous human habitation for a really long time in space. A lot of people don't know. But like people like me, we're just really happy that there's scientists out there who want to do experiments because it's just an excuse for us to build more rockets. So we would say, okay, great. Yeah, do your experiments. We often
don't even have to worry about what those experiments are. We're just glad they exist.
I want so many experiments. I want so many. Like the twin experiment that happened in space, brill. I wish that I could analyze that data.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that like I'm personally really excited about, because like I'm trying to scheme a way to get myself in there. Like when the first like experts are needed on the bio side of something, I want to get in there early and be like, let me help you build a lab. I got this. And so I think that's something I'm personally excited about. I'm also really excited in terms of my current field and where I see myself in the short term for a while is this immunotherapy space, because I just feel like that work really does have the ability to revolutionize cancer treatment. Like we're moving really full speed ahead, especially with even given the circumstances of 2020, things like the COVID vaccine, like we're just about to push things through clinical trials with a lot less bureaucracy and with a lot more ease. And that's kind of important. Like the things that were tested and researched for the purposes of COVID is going to help streamline other infectious disease drugs and also other immunotherapy type drugs. And I think that that's really exciting for us, because there's a lot of excellent ideas out there. And I think with something, you know, like this mRNA vaccine is a completely different mechanism of action. And I think in any other year that would have freaked people out. And now there's hopefully more trust within the general public with the idea that this has been extensively tested for safety. You know, like we were saying before, it's kind of dead in the water if it's not safe. And so everything else is really what you're looking for. And they've kind of gone through all those hoops with a speed that we've just never seen before. It's obviously unprecedented because it's an unprecedented situation, but hopefully it's going to clear a path for a lot of other treatments, making it through trial and getting to patients that need them, as opposed to waiting 10 years for something we knew in year two, right?
That's pretty hopeful.
Yeah. Something I'm worried about.
Yeah, concern.
Climate change. I think about it, I feel like I should be really nervous about, maybe I should be maybe more hyper-specialized in my hopeful moments and in my worries, but I feel like they are usually separated from what I do for a living. I feel, you know, I'm going full speed ahead in what I'm doing in immunotherapy. And so the things that I end up thinking about as being very exciting versus very worrisome are things that are completely outside of my field. And so, yeah, I worry about it because it also kind of feels like there's nothing I can, it doesn't feel like there's anything I can do about it.
Yeah.
And so
that makes it tough.
Yeah. As a go-getter, I wish there, I do have moments where I'm like, should I just abandon what I'm doing and go do that? but no, that's not really the answer. The answer is like, there's a lot of really excellent people working on this too. And we just need to throw resources at them as well. So I think there's not maybe much I can do on the science level for that, but hopefully there's a lot more all of us can do on the advocacy level for that, especially being technical people that can communicate complicated topics to people who maybe don't actually get to integrate, you know, interact with them very often. And so that's probably something I'm most worried about. I'm also worried about, just like I was saying, this is exciting, you know, the unprecedented nature of this year has led to hopefully a streamlined process for other treatments. I also just kind of worry about lingering hesitation on some medicines. I think there are some instances where I understand and I'm empathetic to suspicions surrounding approved medicine. And so one of the things actually I was talking to my mom about, who actually just got the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine today, because she'll be administering it to others soon as a healthcare worker. And so we were talking about how, you know, Miami's a very diverse city and many of the people that she works with are unsure if they want to get the vaccine. And somehow I've become like a stand-in for the only expert in this, even though I'm absolutely not a part of those teams. So like, we'll get it if Seaham's daughter says that we should get it. And I was like, I don't know if I want that responsibility, but you should definitely get it. but you know, like, oh, we're just worried because of like the history around
like other vaccines, totally other vaccines years ago, like
other vaccines. But also I think that there's particular anxieties among communities of color where they just don't want to be tested on, right? And I think that that's coming from a very valid place of anxiety. if any of them are listening, please get the vaccine. This is not one of those instances, although those worries, I think, are very well warranted given the history of it, especially in this country. But then there's some, you know, vaccine deniers where they just think that it's linked to problems that it's not. And I just wish that we as a community, people who are in this field, who are in biotech, who are making the vaccines, who are making those treatments, we're better at communicating data. Like, I think scientists in general sometimes have problems communicating their data. I struggled with it today sometimes to kind of bring it back to a level that was palatable. And I think being able to do that is really tough, but it's work that we need to get better at because we're losing people in the weeds of research that they actually don't need to understand to appreciate the amount of work and critical thinking that goes into it. And so I think I worry about that. I worry about that, like, on our end. I'm not worried about it just in the sense of I worry about these people and they're the problem. It's like, no, I worry about it for us. Like, in general, we need to do better at communicating our science.
Okay, so just a little joke there. There was like a meme that was out where it was like vaccine researcher, and it was like someone maybe like you, like in a lab coat in a lab making an experiment to make the vaccine. It was like anti-vax researcher, and it was like sitting someone on the toilet on their phone, like looking up vax, trying to like debunk it.
So I kind of oscillate between the two. Sometimes I'll have those moments where I'm like, that's hilarious because it's true. And then there's other moments where I'm like, I really am just not going to reach anybody that way. I feel that way about almost any complicated debate, especially having a debate background where it is my instinct to debate a topic. It's just, that's just not how you're going to reach them. You know, I'm not going to reach somebody with the same strategy that I would use in a debate round from when I was a competitive debater. The way to do that is definitely not to minimize your opponent. I think for the most part at the base level, whether it's related to the really problematic history of vaccine or of like treatments in the United States or vaccine deniers who are saying that it's linked to things like autism, which it's not, there's a fundamental problem with the way that we communicate that information, and there's a fundamental problem with the way that we reach those people when we're talking to them. I think there's an instinct to like put people down, right? And I think that that's just not going to be helpful. I saw that a lot, especially with COVID, the way that some people aren't taking it seriously. I thought I want to reach them too. I just don't know if that's going to be the way.
Right.
I'm just not sure. That being said, there's a place for everything. So maybe it's not my way, but it could be somebody else's and it could be effective. But I worry about that on our end as a community. Like, what can we be doing better? Because we can't really, like, if it is that person sitting on a toilet doing anti-vax research, we're never going to reach that person potentially. So we can't really control that part. Like, we have to just control the part that we can, which is how good are we at what we do and how good are we at communicating it? That's kind of how I feel about it.
So Nora, another thing we like to ask is, what advice would you give to a young person who's interested in doing what you do?
If they want to do what I do, the first thing I would say is get into a lab, any lab. Like, I wasn't in research in the way that I do it now, back as an undergrad. But having a large breadth of research experience has put me in a position to where I can kind of be very adaptable and float in lots of different fields. That's a very marketable skill set, to be able to adapt to any type of science that gets thrown at you. And I think the only way to do that is to just do it and fail. Be prepared to fail. You will fail so often and it will be heartbreaking every single time. But if you can do the hard work of not tying your emotional worth to bad data, then you will have done the hardest thing that most scientists can't do, right? Which is separate kind of surprising information from a critique of your own self-worth. Because you get very invested in what you're doing. And I think, especially as an academic. And so I think being able to meet failure with enthusiasm as instead of a roadblock would be probably my biggest advice. And that's not even work that just needs to be done in a lab. That is just like personal work that needs to be done. I'm still doing that work. And so I think Those are probably the big two things. When I was at FIT, somebody said something bluntly to me once. I guess two pieces of really good advice. The first was that if I graduate with my bachelor's degree and you want to be in a hard science and you're doing research and development, right, you're probably going to need to go to graduate school. And so if that doesn't appeal to you, you might want to shift focus. I think that for most people who want to do this, that time is worth it, because what it's forcing you to do is to do a lot of really difficult critical thinking in a very short amount of time. That's really what you get out of grad school, hopefully, if nothing else, which is the ability to problem solve and the ability to think through things on your own independently as a scientist and solve, you know, right? And I think if you can kind of emotionally accept that you're going to go through this process, then you're in a good position to not have a ceiling in the research and development space. I think that there definitely is a ceiling sometimes. I don't know if it should be there. I don't know if having a doctorate should be the end all be all of whether or not you have a place in research and development, but the reality of it at the moment is that for the most part it is. And so I don't want anybody to have a ceiling. Even in my own workplace, one of the things I liked about it was that you didn't actually need a PhD to be in my position. And I love that. With the right amount of experience, you're still a scientist, even without a PhD. But I think the reality of it is that that's not really commonplace. And there is value to a PhD. So get ready to be in a lab. Get ready to fail over and over and over again. Over and over and over. It sounds awful because it is, but it is going to be okay. And then the second piece of really great advice that I got, no matter what field you want to be in, not just my field, is to kind of figure out what motivates you. When I first came into FIT and I wanted to do more bio research originally, I went to the person I ended up doing my senior thesis with, Dr. Grimwade, and I said, well, I have a bone to pick with cancer. Your work is related to cancer, and that is why I want to do it. And I remember she said, that's just not enough of a reason. Hmm. You just can't be motivated by your grief. It's just not good enough. Like, wow. Be motivated by something you like. Be motivated by something you love to think about and love to do. And if it's this, then you can come back and do research here. But until you know that, I don't want you working in the lab. And so I did lots of different types of research. And then as a senior, I liked molecular biology and I liked molecular genetics. It was just the question I wanted to answer. And so I went back to her and I was like, can I work here now? She was like, yeah. Because it didn't, you know, like, I think, and, you know, in my case, it was grief, but I just think, like, the important takeaway from that is, like, find the motivating factor that is derived from a place of joy, genuine curiosity. Like, I really like what I do because I'm genuinely curious about the immune system and how our bodies work and how that system, that very delicate system, is kept running. The application of it is important, but not as important as still answering those questions, right? I want to work in space because I like space, right? And I've liked it since I was a kid. But I work in the T-cell immunotherapy space now for cancer, and I still like it because I'm still answering those similar types of questions. I still am getting what I want out of my research. And I think that'd be true for anybody who wants to do any research. Just figure out what excites you and do that. And don't be motivated by something. Maybe it is a good motivating factor, but it's just not the best one, right? Something like grief, something like stubbornness. Don't be motivated by being stubborn. That's how I almost stayed as an astrobio major. It's just not worth it. And actually, somebody at FIT gave me FIT, full of great advice. Another person at FIT, a professor, gave me great advice when I was switching. I think it was Dr. Oswald.
Terry Oswald,
department head.
Yeah, so
we love him on this.
I love him too. And I told him that I wanted to switch, but I felt bad about myself for switching. And this is when I was a freshman. I said, I feel like if I switch, it means that I failed.
What did he say?
The first of many failures, I would find out, right? So, and he was like, it almost kind of echoes something that I then heard from Dr. Grimwich. Like, it's not a failure because it's what makes you happiest. Like, it's just not worth staying in a degree that you might not like because you're too stubborn to accept that you might be actually genuinely good at something else. Like, go do that thing.
I think it's also something that a lot of people have to relate it to, like, an economic thing. It's like the sunk cost fallacy. It's like, I've already spent a lot of time on something, so if we switch, that is wasted time. But if you're going in the wrong direction and you switch to a right direction, it doesn't matter how many resources you lost, you will continue to lose more
Yeah.
If you're on the incorrect path. Absolutely. So it totally makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I think he was trying to like spare me of that realization as a senior, right? It's like, don't do this until that fallacy just like builds up more precedent in your head. Switch now. And if you hate it, guess what? You can switch again. That's the benefit of being an undergrad. Like you really, it's the most non-committal time of your life. Go ahead and do that. Like finish your degree, make sure you're not making like very irresponsible decisions, but like you can switch around and figure out what you like. That is very common in undergrad, but I've always been so focused as a student that it shocked me that I had made a mistake, right, in my degree. And then I switched and I was happier. And I got to do more specialized courses in the thing that I was interested in biology, in chemistry, than I would have ever been able to in my original degree program. Like that schedule just wouldn't have allowed me the flexibility that I wanted to pursue my curiosity, right? And I got to do that as an undergrad because of that change. And so between that and being told to figure out what I actually like to do bench side to preserve my happiness, I feel like I got really excellent advice on both ends to make it to where I'm still answering questions that I want answered. And it's still very exciting. And it didn't even matter to me that it was an industry versus academia once it was all said and done, because I still get to do what I like to do. And I'm advancing myself to a position that will eventually allow me to lead other people in doing it. And then I get to have my own team of people answering the questions I want answered, not just, you know, working towards a company goal for it. So yeah, get used to failure. Get into a lab, do things because you like them, not for any other reason.
All right. Man, people are going to be lining up to go to FIT to get more great advice. This is fantastic.
I really got very lucky, especially because I'm such a precocious, abrasive person. And I feel like I got so much excellent advice, so much patience from people at FIT, definitely more than I think I would have gotten at a really big state school.
Nora, I just want you to know all of this was just warm up for the most important question.
Oh my God.
This is important. Everything we just talked about was important, but the last question we typically ask, Nora, what is your favorite pizza topping?
Oh yeah. So I came prepared for this.
Yes.
Because so I moved from Austin, Texas recently, and I want to make sure that I get every single one right, because there are multiple toppings on this pizza. And it is my favorite.
Whoa.
It is. So I really like this one pizza I like lots of pizza. Pizza's great. Perfect food. But there's this one pizza in Austin, Texas from Pint House Pizza. And it is called the Ooh La La. And it is the perfect blend of sweet and savory spices. And there's not a pineapple in sight. It is. It is normal red sauce, cheese, fresh mozzarella, pepperoni, baby arugula, spicy local honey, pepper and peppers, and Parmesan cheese. And it's sublime. Excellent. Everything from Pine House is great, but this is it's just my favorite. I love that honey on top. I love that little bit of spicy, sweet drizzled on it. And it is so delicious. I also want to say, I don't actually know, has anybody answered pineapple on this show?
The only answer. I think it's been discussed, but it hasn't been like, that's the answer.
Somebody said it like as a joke. They were like, I'll bet this will make John upset. Pineapple.
Horrible. But the origin story of pineapple on pizza is incredible.
Really?
Yes. And if you haven't heard it, then you should listen. John Green on Anthropocene Review does a really great review of this. But basically, it's just a cross-cultural phenomenon, the pineapple on pizza, because it was a Greek immigrant in Canada making this Italian food inspired by Chinese sweet savory combinations, but ham and pineapple on pizza. And inexplicably, it is most popular in Australia.
Really?
Lots of different countries involved to bring this one horrible pizza to everybody's life. But the origin story is great, especially because like pineapples in general were really valuable back in the day. Like they were a marker of wealth? Question mark? Why? Like even in paintings, there is somebody who dedicates their whole life to cataloging paintings with pineapples in them.
Well, that's interesting. We grow pineapples. Me and my wife, we have like five pineapples growing on the plant. It's a very slow growing plant. I mean, I wonder if that has something to do with it, but it's like,
I mean, it was also just like, it wasn't native to Europe. And so yeah. Okay, we're going to gloss over colonization briefly, but like they colonized areas that did grow pineapples. And so if you were wealthy, then you would have access to pineapples.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That could have something to do. I'll say this, and I've said it before, I'll say it again. I'm from New York. I don't have any problem with pineapples. I mean, the only fundamental problem is like, usually you don't put sweet toppings on pizza. Like that's where the strangeness comes from. And then you talk about honey on your pizza. It's like, okay.
I like a little teeny bit of spicy because it's got chili in it. So it's got, right. It's a spicy honey. I also really like it when there's like a balsamic glaze that's also kind of sweet. It's tart is really what it is, sort of. And so I like that on a pizza as well.
I just personally think there's nothing that you can put on a pizza to ruin it or fundamentally ruin its character. As long as you have like the crust, the sauce, the cheese, you can put whatever on it and then it's just a topping. Where I have issues is when you start changing one of those fundamental ingredients. If you swap out the tomato sauce and put on ranch, that's totally different. It does, but as long as you have that core three ingredients, is my opinion, you're fine.
That offended me. Ranch on the pizza?
I know. It makes me feel dirty saying it.
And like, there's lots of different, I guess, styles too. Obviously, originally being from Jersey, I'm partial to the New York style. But right. I really do like one place does Detroit style pizza that I really like. And so they're square. And the bread, like the crust, is very doughy. And I love that in a pizza. So I love a very doughy crust.
So we brought on Dan Smith, meteorologist, and he told us about Windsor, Ontario pizza, which I believe is right across.
It's a suburb of Detroit, yeah.
It's a suburb of Detroit. And he said they have, in his view, the best pizza scene that he's ever seen.
Oh.
And it's right next to Detroit. So worlds are colliding here. This is fascinating.
Maybe it's the same one. It's just got such a doughy crust, and I love how bready it is. Like, I just like the tactile experience of just sinking your teeth into it is really pleasant. Whereas something like Chicago style pizza just doesn't do it for me. The sauce is on top. That's just kind of strange. And their bread, like their crust, is not doughy in the same way that.
Yeah. I actually haven't had Chicago style ever in my life. I probably should. I only
had it once because of a debate trip. Like, I was competing in Chicago, and they're like, we have to have Chicago style pizza. And then I had it. And I was like, all right, well, I'm not impressed. It was the only time that I'd eaten a pizza that I genuinely was like, I don't like this.
Really?
Like, something about the fundamentals that you just talked about, I feel are disrupted in the Chicago style.
Well, that's the thing about pizza.
Everyone in Chicago will not agree, but that is my hot take.
But I feel you there, because like, for me with pizza, even when it's bad pizza, it's usually still good. Like, it's still a good experience.
We're talking about like maybe
like normal
pizza.
Yeah, like even something like that. Like, okay, it's bad pizza, whatever. But I mean, it's still pizza.
There's a time and place for that. Sometimes I don't want a fancy pizza. Sometimes I want trash pizza.
But it's still good. It's still pizza. It's anyway.
It's great.
Hey, Nora, let's just say someone's out there saying, wow, Nora has it all figured out. Anywhere where people might be able to follow you, Twitter, Instagram, anything like that, just to keep up with your updates.
Yeah, so you can follow me on Instagram. It's just Nora Ashora, Nora _ Ashora. And then inexplicably, my Twitter handle is Ashora E, like my middle initial.
Huh.
Because, and this is true, I accidentally created a Twitter account when Twitter was first becoming a thing on my phone back in the beginning of high school. And I didn't even know that that's what I was doing, because smartphones weren't as smart as they are now. And so I made a Twitter account unbeknownst to me, which has my full name, at Nora Ashora. And all it says on that Twitter account, I'm pretty sure, is Cherry and Koshi. Is that you? Because that was a debate coach that I was texting at the time, but I didn't know I was tweeting at them because I didn't understand what Twitter was. And so
you inadvertently made it.
Yeah. And then I've contacted Twitter on more than one occasion, and they are like, we can't get rid of this account. And I was like, but I am her. I am Nora Ashora. It was me. I was dumb. And they're like, but that email is gone. And so there's no way. It was like a Yahoo email address that I had in high school. And they were like, we just can't get rid of the Twitter. And so there's a dead Twitter, which has my actual name. And then there's the real Twitter, which is Ashora E.
Okay.
Very dumb.
Well,
but it is like that other one is me. It's just dead.
Not going to make any tweets.
No, it's just it's waiting for Cherry and Koshi to respond still to this day.
Well, Nora, this was an outstanding technical talk.
Thank you. I learned a lot.
And there are so many resources out there. I do give a formal presentation of my layman's talk with a Star Wars analogy somewhere on the UT website. If you look it up, there's probably video. But yeah, it is a very cool field, and there's so many resources out there. Hopefully there'll be a lot more with renewed interest after this really ridiculous year in this field. So yeah, thank you for having me. I really like talking about it. I didn't even get to talk about how CD4s are the EVs of the immune system.
True, we didn't. Oh, we need a part two.
Oh, if you want to learn more about the immune system, legit watch the anime Cells at Work. It's on Netflix. It's dubbed. Is it dubbed? Maybe it has subtitles. But there is an anime called Cells at Work that is genuinely pretty accurate about how immune cells work.
Cells at Work, right.
Yeah. It's very cute. Like the platelets in the show are like little kids. And so they call red blood cells big sis, which is very adorable because they are derived from the same progenitor. Just such a cute little touch.
All right. Well, we'll put it in the show notes. That's what we often like to do, especially for things where people can be helped by like visual cues. We'll try to put like links and stuff in. So if anyone wants to, follow along at home.
Cells at Work. Although I have a lingering suspicion that the person who is the science advisor for that show, because there's obviously lots of science advisors for film and TV. I think they might be a neutrophil specialist because they lean heavy into the neutrophils.
Oh, and I'm like, dude,
neutrophils are important, but are they more important than T cells? I'm not sure.
They need a new advisor. I'll let them know that you're open for the role.
So ridiculous. It's a great show, though. It's very fantastic. Cute.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much again, Nora. This was fantastic. And
it was really nice to see you.
Yeah.